My name is Ian O'Neill, and this is How They Did It, a podcast where we learn filmmaking from those who've gone before us. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to How They Did It, a podcast for indie filmmakers, especially those just starting out looking to make their very first film, although anyone at any level can listen and learn. Chris Bournet is a journalist, author, and filmmaker based in Columbus, Ohio, who directed and produced a gem of a documentary called Lady Wrestler, the amazing untold story of African-American women in the ring. There is a lot to cover, so without further ado, here's the interview. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Bournet!
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here. I appreciate
it. Not a problem. I'm so glad to have you. I need you to just give us a little bit of information about you.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, which is a relatively, it's a mid-sized city. It's the capital of Ohio. And it's where this promoter, wrestling promoter, Billy Wolf, established a wrestling enterprise. And I'm not a classically trained filmmaker. I went to Ohio State. My degree is in English, and most of my career has been in newspapers. So I've been a print journalist for most of my career. But I've always been interested in writing and filmmaking. And this story about women wrestlers just kind of came to me through a friend who grew up with one of the women. And I just saw it as an opportunity to finally get my feet wet in filmmaking.
So that's when the filmmaking bug bit you, was for this particular film, or is it a long time ago?
No. I've wanted to be a filmmaker ever since I was a kid. I just didn't sort of get around to it. And I made a couple of short films and experimented here and there over the years, but I didn't get around to making a full-length, feature-length project until this documentary, Lady Wrestler.
Yeah, so you made this documentary, and it's called Lady Wrestler, The Amazing Untold Story of African-American Women in the Ring.
Yes.
So can you give us a description of this project?
Yeah, so this is, as I said, it's a little-known story about the fact that there were dozens of African-American women. First of all, there were dozens of women back in what they call the Golden Age of Wrestling from the 1930s up through, like, the 1950s, so the mid-20th century, basically. And there was a man named Billy Wolf. He was a former wrestler who got into wrestling promotion. He was actually from Missouri, and he discovered, quote unquote, this woman named Mildred Burke, whom he groomed into the first women's world wrestling champion. He married her, and they ended up settling in Columbus. In my research, I didn't exactly uncover why they chose Columbus. I think part of it had to do with the logistics. Columbus is within a day's drive of most of the country, so I think that had to do with it. And there was already another fairly well-known wrestling promoter named Al Haft based in Columbus. So Al Haft and Billy Wolf were members of the National Wrestling Alliance, and they established this wrestling enterprise. And Billy Wolf just thought women's wrestling was like this novelty that would attract a lot of fans to the sport. And then he was, even though he had a lot of flaws, he was a womanizer, and there's kind of a debate about whether he really empowered the women or exploited the women who he recruited into his wrestling business. But he was inspired by Jackie Robinson and was really ahead of his time when it came to race relations. So he thought, just as Jackie Robinson integrated Major League Baseball, he felt if he brought black women into the sport of wrestling, that it would be like a novelty that would attract a lot of attention, and it did.
Yeah, it did. It certainly did. So, you know, I want to ask this first. Why this film? Why this topic for you personally?
Well, a couple of things, because number one, I grew up in Columbus and grew up in the black community. I'm African American and never knew about this story, never knew about these women. So I thought, if I didn't know about this, then there's, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of other people out there who would find this story interesting. So a couple of kind of serendipitous things happened. So I ended up, what happened is, so a friend of mine named Terry Anderson, who's in public relations, when I was working as a print journalist, he would constantly tell me, when I would call him for story ideas, he'd say, Chris, there's this really interesting lady who I grew up with in my neighborhood who was some kind of wrestler or bodybuilder. and always had people like these interesting characters, wrestlers and stuff, hanging out over her house. You should interview her sometime. So that turned out to be this woman named Ethel Johnson, who was like basically the main interview subject in the documentary. So I wrote an article for the daily newspaper in Columbus, the Columbus Dispatch, about Ethel's story. It came out in March of 2006, the first weekend of Women's History Month, which just happens to be the weekend that Arnold Schwarzenegger, the famous movie star and bodybuilder, presents a fitness event every year in Columbus that weekend. Arnold Schwarzenegger's people saw the article and they called me at the newspaper I was working at and they said, "This is really an amazing story. We want to give Ethel Johnson a Lifetime Achievement Award." So Ethel Johnson, even though she was this really worldly, well-traveled woman who had been all over the world, she really, when she was outside of the ring, she was very shy and reserved. And by the time I met her, she was in her 70s. She was a retired grandmother, and she really didn't want a lot of attention, even though she agreed to speak to me. She said, tell them I said thanks, but no thanks. So she turned down a Lifetime Achievement Award from Arnold Schwarzenegger. So I just kind of felt like, I always say, it didn't take Orson Welles to realize her story was cinematic. And at the same time, there was this other documentary about the golden age of women's wrestling called Lipstick and Dynamite. And that movie only briefly mentioned the African-American women. And I thought the African-American women really deserve their own chapter in history. So I thought, why not me? It was a sort of that sort of ignorance is bliss. It's like, okay, wow. I'm not a classically trained filmmaker, but I'll just jump in head first. Excuse me. I was really inspired by Robert Rodriguez, his book Rebel Without a Crew, about how the first movie El Mariachi, basically being a one-man band. And I thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it.
So as long as you didn't sell any blood for it or anything like that, you know, you didn't go into experimental, drugs.
It was all just, it was credit cards and just.
Wow. That's awesome how it fell into your lap. That's just brilliant. So what camera did you use to shoot this?
So I used I went to a local camera shop and bought a used Sony prosumer 3-chip video camera.
Yeah. Yeah, because when I started watching it, I tried to upgrade the resolution. And it's 480. So it's dated. It's a bit dated because you started this when?
Yeah, so I wrote the newspaper article back in 2006, and so after the newspaper article came out, I asked Ethel. I said, "Would you be willing to be interviewed on camera?" And she said, "Yes." So just over the years, on and off. And it was because I was working a day job and balancing a lot of other things and just didn't set a concrete deadline. So I interviewed Ethel, and then in researching the story, I came to find out there were dozens of other women like her. Yeah. So that's when I came across Ramona Isbell, another woman I interviewed in the documentary. And there was actually one woman who I approached named Lula May Provo, who said she didn't want to be interviewed because I think a lot of the women had bad experiences,
right?
And they didn't want to relive that part of their lives.
Yeah.
So it was just on and off. I finished a cut of it in 2012, and we did a screening at a local historic African American theater called the Lincoln Theater, and all the wrestlers and their families were able to attend, and they gave their stamp of approval. And I just kept adding to it from 2012 up through 2018 when I finished the final cut of it.
That's fantastic. Yeah. You know, this again, I have been preaching this on this show since day one. Whatever camera you have, get out there and shoot a film. Look what Chris did. This is a gem of a documentary that you have to see. It's really, it's just, I can't say enough good about this. It's really, it's really quite a feat that you've done too. And we'll get into that. First thing I wanted to ask was, what roles did you take on with this project? Obviously, this was all you.
Yeah. Well, your question kind of reminds me of when Helen Hunt won, it was either the Emmy or some award for the sitcom Mad About You. And she said, "The person I have to thank is Paul Reiser, and Paul Reiser. The person I have to thank is Paul Hill. Paul Hill was a classmate of mine at Fort Hays Career Center, where we both went when we were in high school and took radio and television. So I took radio and television wanting to learn behind the scenes film and television production. Even though a lot of people tell me I have a broadcaster's voice, I had no interest in being on air. I just wanted to learn the behind the scenes stuff. So I never went to film school. As I said, my degree is in English, Paul actually did go to film school. He went to Wright State here in Ohio, and he became the full-time film editor at a state-of-the-art film and video center called the Wexner Center for the Arts at The Ohio State University. They bring in filmmakers from all over the world, and they give them free post-production through fellowships. They've had Spike Lee, they've had Martin Scorsese, they've had all different kinds of mainstream and indie filmmakers from all over the world. So I was able to get a fellowship at the Wexner Center, and it was really Paul Hill, my friend and collaborator, who helped me with the editing, who kind of filled in my gaps of the technical knowledge, who actually used his own like higher grade Sony camera to do some of the interviews. And a filmmaker friend of his named April Martin helped us shoot as well. So I actually did the editing myself, the first round of it on Final Cut on my laptop. And then Paul kind of took my files and put them into an Avid system and just kind of made it more professional. And they have a professional sound recording booth at the Wexner Center. So that's where I did the narration. And I'll do it to my friend Paul Hill and the Wexner Center for the Arts, where the documentary debuted last year.
Wow. It's nice to have friends like that.
It really is.
I think in this business, and I remember interviewing Alex Ferrari about this, and he said, just don't be a dick. And I think I've got it up in my office now on a sign that says, don't be a dick, because you have to collaborate with people, and nobody wants to work with somebody who's being a dick.
Yeah.
So this is perfect. You have this great relationship, and look what came out of it, this wonderful documentary. So congratulations. That's fantastic. Well, since you're on the editing, maybe I can ask about the archival footage that you were using, because there's a lot in there, and a lot of photos as well. And so how did you acquire that, and what did it cost?
Yeah, so some of the photos were from the women themselves. And so Jeff Lean, the Washington Post reporter who wrote the book Queen of the Ring about Mildred Burke, he was really, really instrumental, because when I interviewed him, so I'll try to keep the story as brief as possible, but I met Jeff Lean through another friend named Will Haygood, who's a journalist. We both started out working at an African-American newspaper called The Call and Post. Will's about 10 or 15 years older than me. So he had already left Columbus and was working at the Washington Post in the 90s when I started working at the Call and Post. So to make a long story short, Will, by the time I started working on this documentary, was starting to work on it was a few years before he wrote the article that the movie The Butler with Oprah Winfrey and Forrest Whitaker was based on. So when one of Will's return trips to Columbus promoting one of his books, I mentioned that I was working on this project. He said, well, you have to interview my colleague, Jeff Lean. He's also a reporter at the Washington Post. So I interviewed Jeff Lean, and Jeff Lean was like, if you're really interested in learning about the history of wrestling, you have to go to the University of Notre Dame. They have this huge wrestling archive. So I just made a couple of trips it was like this library at Notre Dame was like this treasure trove. I mean, there were boxes and boxes and boxes of photos, press clippings that had literally been sitting like sealed for decades. No one had ever, or they hadn't been opened for years. So it was like, I literally like, you'd sneeze when you opened a box because it was just dust and, had been sitting for so long. So I just had to pay per photo to get these photos, for the permission to use these photos. So it was like, it varied. So like some of it was as cheap as like $10 for photo, because some of it was already in the public domain.
Right.
So it just varies. And then also I used a couple of online archives. Like one is DV Archive. Another one is Critical Past. It's like some of the clips. So it'd be like, maybe $150 to download some of the clips. So it was just like piecemeal here and there. I didn't start out with like a certain budget to begin with. It was just sort of piecemeal here and there over the years putting it together.
Yeah. Okay. So you also were the director, producer. You were a jack of all trades on this thing.
Yeah.
So I imagine there was a lot of juggling going on because you had a full-time job at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you keep all this straight?
Well, that's that's part of the reason why it took me so long. And if there was anything I would do over again, it would be to give myself a firm deadline and to stick to it, because it took way longer than it needed to.
Yeah.
Luckily, the women were really patient and they really had a lot of faith in me and entrusting their life stories to me, basically.
Yeah.
So as far as the technical part of the editing, so that's where my background as a print journalist, and also I'm a novelist and a playwright. So I wrote like a paper edit. I went through all the transcripts, transcribed everything myself, and then just did like basically wrote a screenplay with the sound bites I wanted to use, and basically turned it into like chapters. Like the first chapter is Billy's Girls, about the history of Billy Wolf, you know. So that made it a lot easier, because I just went through all the footage, selected all the clips, and put it into a screenplay format. So that made it a lot easier. That made the editing a lot easier.
Wow. Yeah. That would be a monumental task.
Yes, it was.
Holy mackerel. So I can just see you sort of putting photos out and having your computer open with videos rolling, and okay, so this will go. Yeah. It's this giant puzzle that you're putting together.
Yeah.
And then you're writing it up.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's wow. Okay, that's a lot of work, man. That is a lot of work. Whoa. Okay, so now we've talked about the editing, but what? So for somebody who wants to produce their own sort of piece, whether it be documentary or whatever, what is entailed in being a producer on something like this?
Well, there's a few different paths. So there's the path I took, which is the do-it-yourself, finance it out of your own pocket model. And the reason I did that was not because have some kind of commitment to like indie filmmaking. It was just because I felt the women were getting older. I didn't want to wait for years and years to try to get grants and try to, you know, go through traditional channels of getting fundraising and like trying to get a production company to sign on board. So I thought I'll just kind of do it myself. So then there's there's the more traditional path of, you know, trying writing a proposal, trying to get grants, submitting the idea to different production companies to see if the production and different foundations that give funding to documentary filmmakers. So there's no one cookie cutter path. There's a variety of different paths. You can say, okay, well, maybe I'll start filming interviews, and then when I get more funding, or when I apply, hopefully this grant I applied for comes through, I can do more interviews. Or you can cut together like a trailer and say, I'll use this trailer to attract private equity, like go to, right, you know, people who have money to spare and say, hey, would you be interested in investing in this documentary? So there's no one path. It's just whatever you feel like you can get accomplished. I wouldn't say the way I did it, jumping in head first with not a whole lot of technical knowledge, is necessarily the best way. It was just, I just had this commitment to getting these women's stories out there.
So here's a question for you, though. Even though you did that,
yeah,
did you not learn a ton by doing
that?
Yeah,
I really, really did. Yeah. And one thing I learned is that no man is an island, truly, because I didn't do it all myself. My friend Paul,
right,
my friend April, the Wexner Center, Jeff Lean,
yeah,
Will Hager. There were so many Terry Anderson for even bringing the idea to me in the first place.
Right.
So the do-it-yourself way of doing things, even doing things that way, you still need other people's help. So
yeah.
I that. And I also learned that I used to think of fundraising and crowdsourcing, or crowdfunding rather, as digital panhandling. And now I think it's perfectly fine to ask friends and family and people who are just interested in the subject matter to invest. So maybe if I had to do all over again, I would get investors and try to hire a professional cinematographer and a sound person. And
you know what you have is really beautiful, though. So congratulations. Trust me, you got to give yourself some credit for what you did. Like I know it was over a long period of time, and it must have been crazy, but man, I got lost in it. It was really great. So you did a ton of interviews for this doc. So first, how you found those people to interview, the subjects.
Yeah.
And then did you do a lot of prep work before your interviews? Like what is Chris Bornet as an interviewer?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, so Terry Anderson, my friend in public relations, is the one who originally brought Ethel Johnson mm-hmm. to me. When I published the story on Ethel Johnson, actually, I'd done a little bit of research through local archives. There's a library called Grandview Heights that had some old articles and stuff about the women. So I'd actually misspelled one of the other wrestlers' names in the article, who I said was Ethel's Pierce. So this woman named Ramona Isbell, I'd actually misspelled it as Israel, like the country in the article.
Right.
So her daughter actually emailed me and said, great article, just so you know, my mother's last name is spelled Isbell. You know, that's her correct. So I said, oh, well, thank you for bringing that to my attention. I've actually started working on a documentary. Would your mother be interested in being interviewed on camera? And she said, sure. So, and then, so Ethel's two sisters, Babs and Marva, had passed away already. So I asked Marva's children, mainly Kim Martin, her daughter, if she'd be willing to be interviewed. And she said, yes. So then I met Jeff Lean, as I mentioned, through my friend, Will Hagen. Right. And then, so Rowdy Piper is, I have his interview featured in the documentary. And that interview came about through a very, very roundabout kind of way. So one of my quirks is, like, I like all different kinds of music, including heavy metal. So one day I was just browsing the internet, and I'm a big Lita Ford fan, you know, who was in the movie, who was in the band The Runaways with Joan Jett.
Right.
So I saw that Lita Ford was going to be signing autographs at this horror convention in Indianapolis, which is about 3 hours away from where I live in Ohio. So I was like, oh, you know, it'd be really cool to meet Lita Ford. And I just happened to see that at that same convention, Rowdy Piper was going to be signing autographs for this sci-fi movie he was in called They Live. And I was like, I should just take my camera and walk up to Rowdy Piper and ask him, hey, would you be willing to be interviewed? And I did. And he said, you know what? I do remember those African-American women. I was friends with Ramona Isbell. And so he was just really forthcoming. He was awesome. He was really approachable. And that just came about because I was interested in meeting Lita Ford, and I just happened to meet Rowdy Piper at the same event.
Wow. Now you interviewed him, but it was just audio, was it not?
Right, because by the time I did the final edit, he had passed away.
He died
of a heart attack, really, like, he was only
61.
And I was like, it seems a little creepy to have him on screen when he's already passed away. So I just decided to use the audio and use a photo of him.
And there you go. There's a decision as a producer what to do. You know, you have to make decisions all the time. And that was one that you made, and you made the right one.
Thank you. Because I can see cutting him out altogether. Because I thought, well, is that disrespectful to have him featured when he's passed away? But I thought, well, just using the audio and using a photo probably would suffice.
Right. Well, that's amazing. Listen, you know what? Something my mom used to say to me all the time is, you won't get to jail for asking. You will not hurt anybody by asking. The worst thing that someone can say is no.
Yeah.
So you walk up to Rowdy Roddy and you say, hey, I'd like to interview you. What's the worst thing that could happen?
Yeah.
He says no. But what's the best thing that could happen? That's what happened. You got an interview with him, and it fit perfectly into the text. It was great.
Yeah.
Well, good for you. So that answers the question of, do you do a lot of prep work for interviews? Sometimes, yes. Sometimes you just walk up to your subject.
Yeah, and another quick story. So I feel like the one major thing that's missing from the documentary is the voice of a female like historian or cultural commentator. So I'd actually met this one fairly well-known cultural commentator at a Martin Luther King event here in Ohio. And I told her about the story, and she was like, that sounds amazing. Come interview me at my house in Washington, D.C. So I drive all the way to Washington, D.C. with my camera and sound equipment. When I get out of the car, I check my email, and she sent me an email saying, I have a conference to go to. I could be able to do the interview. And I tried to talk her into it. I said, you know, it's only going to take like 15 minutes. I'll be in and out, and, you know, I'll be out of your hair. And she said she just refused to do it. So I was like, okay, what's plan B? So I called the Black History Department at Ohio State, you know, and so they connected me with Hassan Jeffries. Hassan Jeffries was amazing. I didn't do any prep work for that interview. I just showed up at his office. Well, I emailed him about the subject matter and said, could you speak about this era of history? And he said, sure. I get there. The interview lasted maybe 20 minutes, and he just went through the whole history of African Americans and segregation and what made these women different in like 20 minutes. I didn't even have any questions prepared for him. I just thought I'll tell him what the subject matter is about and let him talk.
You lucked out. That was brilliant.
I really did.
You lucked out because he was very natural. He was really good.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Good for you. Well, again, that shows so much prep work. Way to go.
Thank
you. You still there? Yeah, you are.
Yeah, I'm good. Still here.
Okay, so we got through that. Listen, and you've already told me how you funded the film. You funded this film yourself.
Yeah, just credit cards and just kind of paying as I went.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you have any idea of how to recoup that? Were you even thinking, I'm going to make this money back again? Or was that just, no, I've got to make this story. That's it.
It was sort of like, it was both. It was like, I've got to make this story. And I thought, well, maybe if I'm able to sell it at some point, maybe if it gets into a big film festival and a distributor picks it up, maybe I'll make the money back. But it was just one of those things where I felt like this story had to get out there. And if that meant all the money I invested was just money that I invested and would never see again, I was fine with that.
Yeah, you made a decision on that. I could tell. That's good. That's good because you know what? The story needed to be told, right?
Thank you. Yeah.
And that has to weigh on you financially too. That, well, if I don't get it back, look what I've contributed.
Yeah, but I didn't. It's just like when you go to any investor in who's going to invest in a movie, you tell them up front, this is, you know, and only invest money that you're willing to never see again. And that's how, right, I felt about it. I went into it with knowing I may not see this money again, but it's totally worth it to get these women's stories out there.
Oh, good for you. Oh, man. Well done. So, you know, on the opening, there's some really cool effects on the opening. And it caught me. It really caught me. Like, I said, I'm watching and I'm not going anywhere.
Wow.
How costly was that for you? Or did you get a friend to do that?
That was totally compliment of this young designer, this young female designer named Heather Shalini Alabado, who I worked with at one of my journalism jobs. And I told her about the project and I said, do you happen to know of it? And I wasn't expecting her to do the graphics. I went to her to ask her, do you know of anyone who's like a freelance graphic designer who could design an opening credit sequence? And she was like, I'll do it. And I was like, okay, well, how much, tell me your rate. And she kept saying, oh, I'll let you know. Why don't you tell me what the project's about? And I'll let you know what my rate is later. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I hope she doesn't come up with some, you know, present me with some $100,000 bill. And so she showed me what she came up with. And I was like, Heather, this is great. What do I owe you? And she was just like, just put my name in the credits along with my web address. And I was like, Heather, I can't do that. You just created this amazing graphic title sequence. I want to pay you something. And she was like, no. She's like, I'm trying to build a business. I want to get commercial work. I want to do more work for movies. So this is my chance to get my name out there. So again, I didn't do it all on my own. It was Heather Shalini Alabado who just donated her talents.
Wow.
Yeah.
You lucked out again.
I did.
Because that's brilliant. It was really good. You can tell her the next time you see her, fantastic work. Really fantastic work.
Okay.
So, you know what? Working with such a small crew, because you've talked about a couple of other people who would, you know, have worked with you.
Yeah.
Is it a blessing or is it a curse?
Well, I think with a documentary, it's a blessing because you want to be really nimble and you don't want to have to spend hours setting up lights and keeping, especially these women who are older and still kind of reticent about talking about the past. You don't want to keep them waiting a really long time. So it was a blessing to be really nimble. The curse part of it comes in where the technical parts that I don't really know that well. It would have been great to have, you know, a professional sound recordist or a professional cinematographer to tell me, hey, you know, if we do this setup a little bit differently or we light it a little bit differently, it'll look a little smoother. Or so, yeah, it would have been great to have a, not so much more people, but people who had a little bit more experience or higher end equipment. That would have been great to have. But having the small crew definitely was a blessing in the doing these intimate interviews.
Beautiful. Any problems arise while you were filming, like that tested your problem solving ability?
Yeah, well, definitely the cultural commentator who had me drive all the way to Washington, D.C. and then told me she didn't want to do it. That made me kind of question, okay, am I on the right path here? Other than that, I can't say that there were any other major, like, technical glitches. There was one shoot I did with Ramona Isbell where it was just me and a camera and a boom mic. And I realized she was, like, maybe 20 minutes into telling her story, and I realized the sound wasn't on. I could see on the camera that you couldn't see the little sound bars. And I said, right. I just said, excuse me, Ramona, you know what? I forgot to turn the microphone on. Would you mind repeating yourself? And she was very patient, and she just said, oh yeah, I know stuff happened, and was willing to go back into everything she had just said. So that was really the only major technical glitch that happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
Again, you lucked out.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Because there could have been a lot more, especially when you're working with such a small crew and you're dashing around and exactly. over a long period of time. Wow. Well,
yeah.
I'm glad that, you know what? I'm glad about your honesty too, and just saying, look, there's a glitch here. I screwed up.
Yeah.
Let's start over if you don't mind. And these women sounded like they were just so nice.
They were. And one of the things that struck me about the women is that although they were very unconventional in their line of work, outside the ring, they were just completely just nice and motherly and nurturing and just complimentary. And Ethel actually passed away last September. Up until she passed away, she just was very sweet and just telling me, thank you for getting my story out there. And I really appreciate all you've done. And Just really sweet, generous women.
Wow. It shows on film. It really does. So you had some really great music in this documentary. So how involved were you in having, you know, laying down that score?
Well, what's interesting, so when I got the fellowship for the Wexner Center, it was like I had 2 weeks, and so I had to take vacation time from my job. And I had been fantasizing about all these composers. Like, I really wanted to get, like, a black female composer. Like, I thought One person who would have really been perfect was the bassist Michelle Ndege Ocello, the African American bassist, and I thought because she composes music, so I had all these grand ideas about who I thought would be a good composer, and I only had 2 weeks to pull it together, and I kind of found out a little bit last minute that the fellowship had come through, so I ended up using just royalty free pre-recorded music.
Beautiful.
And so I just found this library. At the time, it was called Video Blocks, and they had this library of music that came with your subscription. Now I think it's called Story Blocks now. So yeah. In fact, all of the music is, except for the track at the very beginning, Heather, the graphic designer, chose that off of iStock. All of it is pre-recorded. I didn't have a composer. I wanted to have one, but that was just one of those things where out of necessity.
Yeah, but you laid down all the tracks then.
I did. So it's like so Paul and I were working in the editing room, and he was like, okay, it was both of us working and saying, okay, this, like the part where they're talking about racism and segregation, this needs something that's kind of a dramatic kind of a sound.
Right.
So we went through the music library, and we just worked really quickly. I mean, that's one thing I think is if I can ring my own bell for a sec, one of my strengths is I'm very decisive. And being a huge music fan helped a lot. I would listen to 3 or 4 songs and say, okay, let's go with this one. And if it didn't turn out right, then okay, we'd choose something else. But I'm very decisive when it comes to, especially when there's a, I work best under a time crunch. When I have a firm deadline and I have to get stuff done, you have to rise to the occasion.
Wow. I got to remember you for my work. Maybe you've been producing some of my stuff.
Sure.
Holy mackerel. That's amazing. Well, no, I, you know, for somebody who says they didn't have a lot of experience and I thought the music laid down real well. It really did. So congratulations on that. That's a great job. And are you still submitting to festivals right now?
Well, occasionally I'll get an invitation to submit, the documentary played at a couple of small local regional festivals here in Ohio, and we had the screening at the Wexner Center, and I just had a screening at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York.
Yeah.
They invited me to come show there during Women's History Month. So my plan now is to, I feel like I'm kind of, I've done the festival circuit, and I kind of feel like the festival circuit, unless you're at one of the big ones like Toronto or Sun, I mean, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I think a lot of the regional festivals are great, and especially the ones that are focused on like sports where there's really passionate fans that can help spread word of mouth. I really do feel there's value in that. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of feel like the money that I would spend submitting to festivals would be better spent setting up individual screenings. Like I've had several wrestling fans and podcasters and bloggers contact me and say, hey, would you have a screening in LA or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C.? So there's actually a service called Tug. There's several different services where you can book screenings, and the renting the theater is paid for through ticket sales. So you're not paying out of your pocket to like four wall, you know, as they call it, four wall a movie where you, yeah. you're renting theaters and showing the movie on your own rather than through a distributor. So that's my plan now, just to, for the rest of the year, to have screenings where people have contacted me and said there's an interest, and then release yeah. streaming services.
Right. And this is called Tug?
Tug, T-U-G-G.
T-U-G-G.
Funny you mentioned okay. Alex Ferrari, because I heard about it on his Indie Film Hustle podcast.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. And that might help you recoup some of that money you've put into this
yeah.
film.
Yeah, and then different people have suggested to me, why don't you sell T-shirts and why don't you have different merchandise?
Yeah, that's a possibility. But remember, you got to outlay some cash before that comes back. So
yeah, true.
That's a consideration, right? So,
true.
But I mean, you'd have to get the rights to a lot of the photographs and things that
exactly.
you did, or have something
have a logo
completely design. New.
Yeah,
yeah a new logo. But
yeah.
but that is something too that to consider. Well, if you do, let me know, and I'll let everybody else know. So I want to, okay. I kind of want to wrap up on the film by saying this. This film highlights, well, it more aptly exposes segregation. So,
right.
but not only of races, but of sexes.
Yes.
There was a clear divide between men and women, black and white.
Yes.
And these incredible women broke barriers. They made history. Yet, unlike their white counterparts, they have not been recognized for their vast contributions in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
And that is shameful. It's just shameful.
It really is shameful.
I was shocked when you got to the end of this and started talking about that. And I was just, after hearing how horrendous their life had been at times and how fearful they were at times, and still out there breaking barriers.
Yeah.
Both culturally, in gender, it just, and to be ignored is just wrong. So Wrestling Hall of Fame, shame on you. Just
yeah,
shame.
And even like locally, like here in Columbus, where most of the women lived, there's this bridge near a section of town called the King Lincoln District, which is a historically African-American area. So this bridge has murals of different African-Americans who have made an impression around the world. And I feel like at least Ethel Johnson should be on that mural. So her children have, you know, have sort of talked about, how do we petition the city to get her image put on that mural, on that bridge?
That would be amazing.
Yeah. So even local recognition would be great.
Well, you know, here's how I measure the quality of a film. And I talked to you about this before we came on air. I lost track of time when I was watching your film. I was immersed in the film, and then it was over. And that, to me, says this is a really good film. Because you caught my attention, you kept it, your pacing was amazing, the information was incredible. The topic was something I didn't care about. I got to be honest. And yet, as soon as I started watching, I couldn't stop.
Yeah.
So congratulations. Seriously, Chris, great job.
Well, that's a huge compliment. That really is the highest compliment when someone tells you they lost track of time watching a movie. That's the highest compliment. So I really appreciate it.
Oh, no worries, man. You earned it. You earned it. This, and especially now hearing that you did it on shoestring budget, you know, camera you went out and bought quickly. And, you know, so people out there, forgive the, you know, the low resolution of this film. Forget
yeah.
about it. You're going to forget about it. Once you start watching it, you're going to forget about it. You're just going to get sucked into it. And it is such, an amazing tale. You've got to watch this movie. And that brings me to, where can people see it? Or can they?
So the website, LadyWrestlerMovie.com, is where I'll be listing the upcoming screenings. And I'll also, once I confirm the release dates of the release on Amazon and iTunes, I'll be listing it there on the website.
Oh, beautiful. Because people have to see this film. It was really good. So what's next for you?
So I've actually started pre-production on my first narrative full-length movie called Things Are Tough All Over. It's about a black family struggling through the Great Recession of 2008.
This, I can say, I've read the script.
Yeah, thank
and
you.
I love thank it. I think it's awesome. It's a really good story. I want to see it. So get it done, okay? Because, you know, I want to see it. No, that's great. Okay, so we are down to what I call the big three, which is the final three questions I ask everybody who comes on to the show. So, Chris, what is the biggest filmmaking mistake you ever made, and how did you overcome it?
Yeah, so I think, as I said, I think taking the do-it-yourself mentality to an extreme and not doing any fundraising, I think if I had it to do all over again, I would do some fundraising. I would at least try to seek out some grants, because I know there are foundations who especially that are devoted to preserving history. So I think I could have gotten some grants. So I think if I had to do that all over again, I would. And how I overcame it was just kind of sucking it up and saying, I'm investing in these women's stories. I'm investing in a project that'll outlive me. So that's what kept me motivated to finish.
I could just imagine, because wrestling fans are rabid.
Yes.
You either love wrestling or you hate wrestling.
Exactly.
And when you love wrestling, if you were to put out a crowdfunding for this, they would have been all over it.
Well, I started.
Wow.
I started before Kickstarter was really, really kind of a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, true. So, so that it's all timing. Timing is everything, right?
Yeah.
So what is the best filmmaking advice you ever received?
I think the best filmmaking advice I ever heard was basically, as I mentioned, I was inspired by reading Robert Rodriguez's book, Rebel Without a Crew, is just to take action. You know, rather than waiting until you have everything in place before you have some, you know, sugar daddy or sugar mama who's going to give you millions of dollars to do your movie idea so that it can compare with Star Wars and any other big blockbuster out that. Just start making movies, even if you just start with shorts or doing a documentary like I did. Just take action, and the more action you take, the more momentum you get, the more experience you'll get. And I think it's just really important just to, like the old Nike ad, just do it.
Oh, yeah. Do it. People, listen to Chris. Take the camera you've got. I don't care if it's your phone. It's all about story. Get a great story like he did, and get out there and shoot.
Yeah.
Listen to this man. He knows what he's talking about. Okay. Name a film that inspired you.
So, as I mentioned, I'm a huge music fan. I'm a really, really big Prince fan. So seeing Purple Rain in the summer of 84 when I was in middle school, that movie really, really changed my life because, number one, I come from an interracial family. I have white step parents and biracial siblings. So in the movie, Prince plays a biracial musician whose mother's white, whose father is black. So that reflected my family, which I didn't see reflected in many movies or TV shows. Number two, Prince, like me, was from flyover territory, as they call it. He grew up and was born and raised and continued to live up until the day he died in Minneapolis. So Minneapolis, much like Columbus, is this mid-sized city that's, even though it's kind of like, you know, it's in the Midwest where it's fairly conservative, it's kind of this progressive city where there was a lot of race mixing. So seeing Purple Rain and seeing that someone who lived in a mid-sized Midwestern city like me could have internationals. I'm getting emotional even talking about it. International success really, really changed my life. So I have to say Purple Rain was one of the most influential movies of my entire life.
Well, you know what? Thanks for sharing that. You know, that's amazing. And that's what it is. It's something that either affects you as a filmmaker or it affects you in your life. And it affected your life. Wow.
Yeah.
You have been, my friend, an amazing guest today.
Thank you.
I I can't thank you enough for first making this film, second allowing me to see it, and then third for being here today and talking about it.
Well, it's been my privilege. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I appreciate every opportunity to bring awareness to these women's stories.
Where can people find out about what you're up to? Is it on your website?
Yeah, so there's the film's website, ladywrestlermovie.com, and then there's my personal website, chrisbornet.com.
Okay. I will have that in the show notes so people can drop by on you and find out where to see the film. And again, Chris, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Ian. I really appreciate it.
That's our show for today, and I can't thank you enough for spending your valuable time with me. I greatly appreciate it. I really hope that you learned something from today's episode, and just as importantly, that you enjoyed it. As always, if you have any comments or questions about the show, please stop by my Facebook page at How They Did It Podcast. I'm on Twitter at HFilmmaking and on Instagram at How They Did It Filmmaking. Please show your support for the show by subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Thanks again for joining me, and I'll be back with another show next week. Until then, keep shooting.